to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located in the beautiful city of Shasta Lake.
Downtown metropolitan Shasta Lake, I think is what you meant.
There, that's okay, correct.
Just checking.
3119 Twinview Boulevard. And they've got everything you want in John Deere. They've got mowers, they've got tractors, implements, parts, service. They do it all up there. Go up and see them. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
There you go.
Yeah.
So we are airing the show live on June 2nd, 2024. And I don't know. There's been a lot going on. Sorry, we've had you running in archives the last few weeks. But I don't know. Just had a bunch of stuff to do. Got busy and got rolled on the schedule there. So we're back at it. Today we have two guests talking kind of same topic, really. I was inspired. Got an email from our friend Stephen Manfredi, and he asked if we could have Phil Kirpin on, which is always a yes answer, about his article, Stop Biden's Illegal Attack on Gas-Powered Cars. And it's like, ugh, yes. Good God, can we talk about it for like a week? That would be so great. But he wasn't available for an entire week. He was only available for an hour. So the second half, we have Dr. Judith Curry, who is back with us. And she is the climate scientist who got out of the climate coven and decided to tell the truth. I'm sure she always told the truth. But anyway, she to her detriment, she is a truth teller. So she'll be on the second hour, and we'll probably talk about some turbulence. Because right on the heels of getting the thing about Phil's great article and all that, I thought, oh my God, are you kidding me?
Oh, turbulence is
being caused by people now.
No, it's being caused by climate change.
Right, yeah. By people.
By people, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we need to stop that.
Idiots. So anyway, let's spin here. Let's see. Phil, we have had him on before, and I've got five previous shows linked. You should go listen to him. They're really good. He packs a ton of information into a short period of time. He is a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. Previously worked at the Free Enterprise Fund and the Club for Growth and also the Cato Institute. He's also a nationally syndicated columnist and chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, author of the 2011 book Democracy Denied. He is currently the president of American Commitment, that is dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, and constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. If those things are not appealing to you, you should probably stop listening. Or maybe you should listen more often.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah, let's
go with that. I want to change my answer. You should listen more often. But you might feel frustrated for a little while. You'll like it in the end, though. Those are all good things. They engage in critical public policy fights over the size and intrusiveness of government. God knows we've got plenty of that. Through direct advocacy, strategic policy analysis, and grassroots mobilization. And I'll tell you, a lot of our grassroots mobilization could really use some strategic policy analysis. So my hat's off to you, Phil. I applaud what you guys are doing. And I don't know where you would like to start today, but the floor is yours. Thank you for coming
on.
Well,
I think that I think it's kind of a remarkable situation right now, what's going on with electric vehicles, because a few years ago, the whole industry kind of bought into this idea that we're all going all electric, with basically one exception. Toyota was sort of hesitant, but all the other manufacturers jumped in with 2 feet, said, you know, we're going to go all electric, we're going to phase out our internal combustion vehicles. They did their big agreement with the California Air Resources Board, because Obama did this basically scam where they let California set standards for the whole country and for the industry. And then I remember there was the line Carol Browner said, we put nothing in writing ever, when she was the Obama EPA administrator, and she cut that deal. With Mary Nichols, who was running CARB at the time. And it kind of worked for a while, at least if all you care about is market share, it kind of worked. I mean, we had all of these subsidies, and we got these explicit subsidies through the tax code and these implicit subsidies through regulatory credits through the California ZEV program. And they took electric vehicles from, about 1% market share to about 8%, which is where it was, last year. It was a little under 8%. for pure EVs, and it was a similar amount for hybrids. So together, hybrids and EVs were about 15% of vehicle sales last year. The rest, 85%, were regular internal combustion vehicles. And, you know, that's pretty amazing from where it was, but here's the problem for those guys who are so obsessed with this. It's not really rising anymore. It's basically flattened out. And, you know, to get to their dream of getting everyone out of an internal combustion vehicle, subsidies are not going to do it. No matter how lavish those subsidies are, it's pretty clear that subsidies are not going to be sufficient. And that's why they're using mandates. And they now have two very aggressive mandate schemes. They've got the California scheme under a federal waiver that Biden granted. And that scheme is now being followed by about 10 states. Model year 2027, which is only 2 years away, 43% of vehicles have to be plug-in hybrid or full electric in California and the other 10 states that are following that. 2027, that's like 2 years from now. That's really right around the corner. And then, of course, you know, that gets more draconian over time until it gets to 2035, where it's 100%. You've got a total ban on internal combustion vehicles in those 10 states in 2035. And then there's what Biden's doing for the rest of the country via the EPA, which is basically the same thing, but 2 years later, and they're hiding some of the years. So they only showed the numbers out to 2032, but in 2032, that national mandate goes to 68% of all vehicles. So basically only about 30% of all vehicles sold nationally are going to be allowed to be internal combustion vehicles. And even model year 2027, which is just a couple of years away, it's 32% under the national Biden EPA mandate. And so you're going to take about 85% of the market, and you're going to squeeze it down to about 68%, and which is to say a lot of people who want an internal combustion vehicle will be prohibited by law from getting one. And if, you know, if you've got listeners who think, oh, California's crazy, but I can always go across the border and buy the vehicle I want, well, maybe not. With these national mandates, the whole national market is going to have a cap on how many internal combustion vehicles can be sold, and that means that you're going to have trouble finding one. And if you can find one, it's going to cost a lot because there's going to be a lot more people who want them than the number of vehicles that are allowed to be sold. And, you know, this problem gets much worse over the next decade, but it's going to hit pretty hard just in the next 2 years. And I think that there's a reason that when President Trump called this a bloodbath, all they could do was attack him for using the word. They couldn't actually say he was wrong on the facts of what's going to happen to the automotive industry. And I fear that if we don't get these policies reversed, now, there are a lot of people that just an electric vehicle is not going to work for them for whatever reason, and they're going to be stuck, I think, with, you know, it's going to be like a Cuba-type scenario. They're just going to keep their old car forever and just repair it and whatever it takes just because, you know, they're not going to be able to buy a new car that actually works for them when the only thing available is an electric. So that's the path that we're on. I think this ought to be a top two or three issue for the election. I really do.
I do, too.
Well, I think what you're saying about repairing your old one, right now in California, as of January, they made it. They put a ban on buying gasoline-powered lawn equipment, and that would under or 25 horse and under, which includes like 99% of your riding lawnmowers, all your handheld equipment, your edgers, your trimmers, your, you know, weed whackers. All that stuff has to be electric now. And what we're finding
is that for the leaf blowers too.
Yep. Yep, anything under 25 horse has to be electric. Now, you can continue to use what you already have, and you can repair what you already have. You just, as a retailer, you can't sell them in California. So we're seeing two things. One, people are fixing their old machines and just staying with them because they don't want electric. They don't want to be mandated. Nobody wants to be mandated on anything. Also, we're seeing people saying exactly what you just said. Oh, I'll just go over the border and, mm-hmm. and buy one. And
why
well,
not?
they've kind of clamped down on that already by saying you have to have an out-of-state address in order to purchase one in say Nevada or Oregon, which are the two closest states to California. You can't, you know, they won't sell you one unless you have a out-of-state address. So. You know, when it comes to the EVs, I think the same thing's going to be true. You're not going to have a choice, and that's why I think it's really so important to get this reversed. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We actually have a, we've got like a total ban on gas leaf blowers in D.C. Like not even your old one. You can't use it. They'll like come write you a ticket and all this kind of stuff. And I talked to my friend who has a lawn care business, and he said, you know, we have all the electric ones, but they don't work very well. We got like the top of the line ones, but they don't work very well. And so like we have to decide, do we want to do a good job and maybe have someone call and we get a big fine, or do we use the ones we're supposed to use and like it takes forever and we can't get all the leaves. And so this is what the genius has brought to us here in D.C. But, you know, look, I think that if their vision is to get everyone out of their gas-powered cars and trucks, they're definitely not going to be satisfied even with a sale. Even when they have a national sales ban, they're not going to be satisfied. At some point, they're going to say you can't renew your registration if you have an internal combustion vehicle, and they're going to take away all the vehicles that we already have. Because if they don't do that, people will keep them forever. And so I think there are a lot more shoes still to drop with this. And, you know, I think that what we have to do when this is the thing that makes me so angry about this. There was no vote. Okay, Congress didn't vote to do this. They did this through the EPA. They did both the California and the national through the EPA. The EPA granted California a waiver, did set their own, they do the total ban, and then they set a standard for the rest of the country that basically follows 2 years after. Our elected officials never would have approved that. They never would have voted for that. We probably would have got a dozen Democrats or more that would have voted against it. And so we've got kind of a broken policy-making system where you can take, you know, the 1970 Clean Air Act and say, well, because of global warming, this means we can ban gas cars. And this is essentially what they've done. And, you know, maybe the courts will save us from it. I try not to get too invested in that happening because they let us down a lot. But I really think, you know, we've got to tell our elected officials, the people we actually do get to vote for, that they've got to step in. They've got to stop having these broad, vague laws on the books that let the bureaucrats make all the real decisions, because it's a total abdication of what they're supposed to do, of what their constitutional role is supposed to be. And, you know, we've actually already had votes in the House and Senate on overturning these electric vehicle mandates, and we had bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate. Now, we haven't got it to the president's desk yet because there was a filibuster on the Senate. One, it got 52 votes. It didn't get the 60 that needed. But we're going to have another run at this in the fall, and we're using a process called the Congressional Review Act. It's been introduced in the Senate by Pete Ricketts from Nebraska and in the House by John James from Michigan. And this process is privileged. It cannot be filibustered. And so we will get it to the president's desk, and we'll get it to the president's desk probably pretty shortly before the election. And what I'm hoping is that we can get massive public backlash and public pressure, so that citizen engagement you were talking about from our mission statement, get as many votes as possible, big bipartisan majorities, get more than that 52 we had in the Senate, get up 56, 57, 58 maybe. I don't think we're going to get to veto-proof, but I think we're going to, if we get enough awareness of this, we're going to force Biden to think long and hard about actually vetoing this overturn of his mandates. And, you know, and if he does it anyway, then he should suffer on Election Day. But we're going to do everything we can to elevate the issue and get it to his desk and put as much pressure on that as we can. So that's my strategy on this for the rest of the year.
Well, and what kind of support are you seeing? Like, I'm sure the public is basically behind it. Who's pushing back on it? Just the usual suspects?
Well, it's interesting. Normally all the green groups, and there's some of that, but, you know, one of the three Democrats who voted with us last time we had a test vote in the Senate was Sherrod Brown from Ohio, who's a huge lefty and a huge green guy, and they gave him a total pass because they know he has a tough race. And so, you know, I think that if Biden decided politically he had to back off this, I think they'd let him. I really do. I mean, maybe I'm crazy, but I think they would. So I don't know. I mean, look, the pushback is everyone you think it would be. Also, to a certain extent, one of the reasons I really worry about this is most of the automakers are bought into this idea of forcing everyone to get an electric vehicle. Most of them are. Toyota's an exception. The dealers are very against it because they kind of get that this will destroy their business. But most of the manufacturers are kind of like, we made our deal. We're okay with it.
Yeah, so and I think somebody bailed on that. Was it Ford? We have to take a really quick break. Let's ponder and come back with that. But somebody pushed back on that, and I guess I'm curious – you know, can they help us out? I mean, will they help us out, or is it, you know, they bow to the overlords because they're afraid they'll get crushed? Our guest is Phil Kirpin. He is discussing with us this whole idea of rulemaking that will force us out of our gas-powered cars. And if you think you just, yeah, you're going to get out of it because you don't live in California or a blue state, good luck with that. It's coming for everybody. So it's good information for everyone. You can follow us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Yeah. We'll just go down to Electric Avenue. That's where we're going to get all the power for the gas-powered cars.
I love the music choice.
It's because it's magic, right? We just get electricity from, you know. Electricity just comes out of nowhere. Just comes out of the plug, you know, and out of the wall.
I'm sure you saw the legislative proposal in Sacramento that would make all the home EV chargers two-way chargers, so when the grid needs power, they can just empty your tank in your garage and take it out of your car.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, that's the, you know, that's one of the major problems with this whole EV push is our infrastructure is not set up for it, and it certainly isn't going to be set up for it in the time frame they're pushing this this legislation to become effective. One of the stories that I heard just recently in our town, and we're not a huge town, we're
100,000 people.
100,000 people. One of our major car dealers here in town, I don't want to name names, but the manufacturer that they represent has recently said if you want to continue to be a Tier 1 dealer, you have to invest in electric vehicles and stock electric vehicles, or you're going to downgrade you and you're going to, you know, basically get the scraps of what's left over after everybody else gets their cars. So our dealer elected to go ahead and make the investment, which is, from what I understand, like $1 million investment in charging stations, storage, and so on. They put their permit forward to do their upgrade, and our local utility said, no, we can't handle that kind of draw. If you turn it on, it'll dump our grid. And we've got several auto dealers here in town that are going to be in the same position. So what's that do for them when their manufacturer says you have to do it, but our local utility says no, we can't handle it? And that's going to be a problem in a lot of places. So, you know, what's the answer to that?
Yeah, look, anytime you try to use force, you try to use, you know, government policy, regulation, legislation, mandates, you try to use force to change economic reality, facts on the ground, you're just going to have massive practical logistical problems. You know, if this were happening on its own in the market, then there would be business opportunities. People would meet the needs. It would kind of happen organically the way most market, developments do. When government's forcing it, you create a lot of problems. You create a lot of logistical challenges that in many cases may be insurmountable. And I think that's certainly what your dealerships there are dealing with. And, you know, they've got, I mean, you would hope that the manufacturers would give them some leeway, at least until, give them more time or something to get those upgrades to the electric infrastructure. But there's not a lot you can do. you know, in most places you've got a monopoly utility, and if they can't service you, they can't service you, right?
Let's see, back to your complaint about mandates, though. You know, if it's mandated that the auto manufacturers do it, well, then it's mandated the dealerships do it. But if the city can't provide the power, right?
Yeah. Well, you're not allowed. Well, I mean, look, when they ban selling, you know, when they ban selling internal combustion vehicles, if you're not set up to sell electric and you can't get the electricity connection you need, you're out of business, right? The only thing you're allowed to do, the only thing you're allowed to sell, you can't sell because you can't get the support for it, and so. A lot of businesses are going to be squeezed, and I think that, you know, it's interesting to me. One of the differences between the Tesla model and traditional car manufacturers, they don't use dealers at all. They have showrooms and they sell direct from the manufacturer, and that's it. And, you know, that may be how some of the electrics go in the future. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of the traditional auto manufacturers are pretty envious of kind of what Tesla's done, and you know they don't love that they have to deal with their dealers, and their dealers have in some places a lot of power, and so you know I don't know. I mean, I think the dealers are kind of in the worst position of anyone in this, really, and they're the ones who need to be the most organized to push back and to get a lot of pressure on Congress to step in and do something about it. And, you know, and it really needs to be Congress. We do need to have Congress act, because look, Trump repealed all this stuff when he was in. But what the manufacturers basically said is like, okay, well, he's only going to be here for a few years. We can't make our long-term plan based on that, because we know when Democrats are in, they're going to put everything right back in place. And basically, you know, almost all the manufacturers, there are a couple exceptions, but almost all the manufacturers, when Trump repealed the federal rule, said we're sticking with California's rules anyway. We're not going to fight it. And so we really need to elect a Congress that's going to say, you know what, it's a matter of national policy, national law, that people can buy the cars and trucks they want, and they're not going to be prohibited from doing so by state or federal regulation. And you know, until we get that done, I'm afraid that we're going to stay on this track. And by the way, a lot of the advocates of these policies know that there are huge logistical challenges and even resource constraints to be able to build, you know, enough electric vehicles to replace all the internal combustion vehicles. And when they get pressed on this, they admit that many people will not get an EV to replace their banned internal combustion vehicle. They'll have no car at all. There's a guy named Jigar Shah who works for the Energy Department, who's actually in charge of $350 billion in loan guarantees, and he's giving them out, you know, all his favorite, you know, he gives them out basically to companies that give to his nonprofit, and it's all very corrupt, and, you know, the way you would expect it to be in an administration like this one. But he had a post on X, I don't know, 6 months ago now, it was a while ago now, but he basically said, it was something, and this is a paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, but it was basically like, we know we can't replace all the internal combustion vehicles with EVs. We're going to have to replace a lot of them with mass transit and micro mobility. So I had to Google what micro mobility means, and it seems to mean electric scooters.
Yeah. Yeah. I I think I would wager that most people in this country don't realize that in markets like California, electric vehicles, and not just California, Texas, some of the other bigger states, you don't really have a choice. You have to have a vehicle. A lot of these small towns don't have mass transit. They don't have transit systems to get you back and forth to work every day, economically anyway. And you can get in your car in California and drive the length of the state, and it's all day and then some. You go back east, and you can travel five states in a day. You have to have a reliable source of transportation in California that can get you quite a ways down the road before you have to refuel. Electric isn't doing that right now. I don't know. I think it's, what, 300, 400 miles you can travel in an electric vehicle before you got to charge it up. That doesn't get you very far in California.
No, especially not up where we are.
No.
Well, also, you know, it's not a sensible use of resources. The market would never allocate resources the way they're doing by policy, because to get that 300-mile range, you have to have an enormous, enormous battery in that thing, and then you have a very high vehicle weight, and you've got a huge amount of lithium and all the other elements that go into that. And, you know, the real benefit of electric is you know, can you charge it up and do your daily driving and then charge it up again the next night? And, you know, you don't need to refuel on a long trip. You know, that kind of, that's the idea of hybrid. And if we went with the hybrid, a friend of mine who worked at Toyota told me that with the amount of lithium and other materials that go into one of these kind of, you know, the longest range electric vehicles, they can make 6 hybrids. And those 6 hybrids would have much more emissions reduction than you get out of the one pure electric vehicle because you have much more efficiency, and, you know, you're much better use of resources. And so if they're really sincere, if this is really about the environment, they would be pushing hybrids, and they're obsessively pushing the pure electrics instead. So I think it's about control. I think this is, the same old story of, you know, we want people under our control, and we want your transportation to be controlled by us, and we can stop you from moving if we want to. And it connects to a lot of the other, you know, kind of nefarious trends that are going on. And yeah, I think a traditional vehicle that you own and you can drive where you want, it's, in a way, it's synonymous with freedom, right? You have the control.
Absolutely.
To, you know, conquer vast distances, choose where you want to go, what you want to do. You never have that with a mass transit or a scooter. Or even really an electric vehicle, if it's your only vehicle. And I think, I know a lot of people who have them and love them, but it's always like their second car, right? It's the one they use for the commuting and whatever, you know, the around town. But everyone always has another vehicle for intercity travel, right? So the idea you're going to replace all the cars with it, it really doesn't make a lot of sense unless we take a big step back, in terms of our freedom and our ability to move around, which is kind of contrary to the values that a lot of us hold. And so I do think this is a top tier issue. I hope that President Trump keeps talking about it and, you know, keep calling it a bloodbath. I think that's accurate.
Well, and I think the danger for all of us is to say, well, they'll never be able to do that. You know, I think that voice is getting a little smaller now because they've gotten away with so much on every front. The idea that, well, we all know it's unworkable, but they've mandated all sorts of unworkable things.
Well, this is the best thing they have going for them. The best thing Biden has going for him is that most people just don't believe this is actually happening. You know, I mean, you tell them and by the way, he's got backing him up all of the fake news. So, you know, the New York Times has like headlines like, "No, it's not true. Biden's not banning gas cars." And you're like, "What are you talking about?" There are 10 states that have a total ban on the books thanks to Biden's policy, and the rest of the country is 2 years behind. But they, you know, they deny, they obfuscate, and they feed the idea for most people that, oh, that's not happening, or if it is, it's way in the future. And if Biden gets a second term, 2 years from now, the availability of internal combustion vehicles on dealer lots is going to be severely constrained. It's going to be constrained to well below what the market demand is, and the prices are going to go haywire. It's not a distant thing. It's a model year 2027 issue.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, getting back to the gas mower situation, that mandate took effect in January. It was actually passed a couple of years ago to take effect in 2024, and I think most people, like you just said, didn't believe it would ever happen or didn't pay attention that this was coming. And every day since then, and including Friday, we get people coming into our dealership looking for gas mowers. And when we tell them, no, we can't sell them in California anymore, they're shocked. Well, when did that happen? It happened in January. And they just get a blank look on their face like, you know, I didn't know anything about that. Well, that's what's going to happen with EVs, I'm afraid, is you know, people are going to decide they want to buy a new car and go down to the lot and, you know, plug it in because that's all you're going to get. People really do need to pay attention to this and speak out because it will come. And I don't know, is there more people can do to kind of head this off?
Well, I think the most important thing we can do right now is try to get as much support as possible on the bill to ban the mandates and get that to the president's desk with, you know, a huge amount of support and pressure on him and, you know, make him
make him really feel some political pain if he does veto it, which he probably will, but make it a tough one for him. And so if people go to AmericanCommitment.org, right on the front, it's one of the featured things. If it's not up, wait a second, it'll rotate through. But on AmericanCommitment.org, we've got a pre-written letter that you can send to your senators and to your congressmen, and you can edit it however you want, and we'll deliver that for you. And we've got to build as much support as possible, get good bipartisan totals in the House and the Senate, and then really pressure him and make it a major focus, get people to pay attention to it in the fall. I mean, this is the, you know, Democrats want this election to be about anything but policy, right? They know that if we're comparing economic outcomes and policies and what the candidates actually will do with the office, then Biden's going to lose to Trump every time. So they want it to be about, you know, hush money and, you know, election denial and whatever other nonsense. And what we really need to do is point out there's some huge, huge policy differences that really, really matter for people's lives. And I think getting as much pressure on, you know, this vote on the EV mandates as possible is a big part of, you know, making that one of the top tier issues. And, you know, if he feels enough heat, maybe he'll sign it, and we'll you know, the way this is written, it's a total victory. EPA would never be able to do this again. It bans them from doing it. And so that would be an amazing thing, even if it saves him politically. And, you know, if he does veto it, which, as I said, is more likely, then, you know, you appeal to the voters and you take it into Election Day. So that's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And what I'll do is I'll post that. It just went away. HJ Rez. It goes away too quick. 136. House Joint Resolution 136.
Yeah. And then it's got a Senate number also.
Correct. 75. Yeah. I think it's.
Yeah, there you go.
Guys, got to slow down your spinner at the front of your
side. I'll tell the website it's rolling too fast.
I'm like, it's out of the other ones. I have to. It's gone. Oh my gosh! But you know what? I will make it stop on that page, and I will post it. And there is a link to AmericanCommitment.org on our site as well. So let's take a break at this point, and then we'll come back, and we'll have you as our hostage to the top of the hour, and. We can chat about anything we have forgotten, which obviously there's probably a lot. Our guest is Phil Kirpin.
Right.
He is with American Commitment, and you can find them at AmericanCommitment.org. We will have this show on archive of commercial-free to listen to. Always all of our shows, you can do whatever you like with them. We don't copyright for that reason. You can find that at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore, no more self-reliance.
In the morning you go running for the man who stole your water. Then you fight till he is dawning, but they catch you at the border. And the mourners are all singing as they drag you by your feet. But the
All righty, Phil. What did we miss? Anything good that we should be including in this decision here for people? Anybody who's not sold, they're thinking, oh, electric cars are great. It's going to save the planet. Are you in the cone of silence?
I don't.
Yep, you were in the cone of silence.
Wait, can you not hear me?
Yep, you're back again. You're out of the cone.
Oh, sorry about that. I didn't know I was in a cone. You know, we might mention that the government didn't build any gas stations. Okay, there are gas stations all over the country because there was demand for that and
right.
People supplied it because there was an economic opportunity. That's generally how we do things in our economic system. But Biden, under his infrastructure law, says that he's going to build 500,000 government-funded electric vehicle charging stations, and he put $7.5 billion of our money, billion with a B, $7.5 billion of our money into this effort to build supposedly 500,000 charging stations. And I don't know if you saw this, about 2 weeks ago now, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, our esteemed Secretary of Transportation, got hammered on CBS, of all places. The interviewer was like, we asked your department how many charging stations have been built so far, and they said 7 or 8. And she was like, you know, and he was like, oh, it takes a long time, and all this kind of, and she's like, 7 or 8? Really? It's been 3 years since this passed.
Oh, yeah, it was like, what, $7.5 billion, and they built 7,
yeah. Yeah. Well, here's the other thing that was amazing to me, is it's like, so you're spending more than $1 billion per so far, but you can't track whether it's 7 or 8? Like, you know, you would think when it's in the single digits, you would keep an exact count. Like, I mean, the guy could use his fingers, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
well, when it's $1 billion per charging station.
7 or 8. I'm like, 7 or 8. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So, look, I mean, my point being that this idea that you can force the country to adopt something much faster than, you know, the people's actual wants and preferences would cause it to occur, if it occurs at all, means you've got to replace, you know, a lot of things the market would do in a normal, you know, economic, and, you know, just for being driven by economics, you got to try to replace it with government spending. And, you know, besides all the philosophical reasons and economic reasons, that's a bad idea. The government's just really bad at it. They're not good at actually doing the things that they say they're going to do. And I think the fact that, you know, we're 3 years in, and they don't even know if it's 7 or 8, but, you know, it's single digits either way.
Well, then on the heels of that, to turn around and say they're still going to build 500,000 in the next 10 years, I mean...
Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, that's not even... I mean, who would believe that at this point? I mean, it's ludicrous to believe that they're going to just all of a sudden get on the bandwagon and start cranking out these charging stations in the next 10 years. I mean, that's... You know, it's nuts, and that's our money there.
Yeah, I think you and I know what they'll do. They'll come back and say, "Oh, the 7.5 wasn't enough. We need another 20 billion on," and it'll be like all these other governments.
Yeah,
I mean, how's your bullet train going in California?
Yeah, exactly.
You mean the one that's going to go 50 miles? Yeah. Everybody wants
to go.
It's
going to go Mercedes Bakersfield for $100 billion.
Yeah, everyone wants to go fast for 50 miles. Well, the funny part is when they looked at the cities, one of them was Pixley, which is the same town that was on Petticoat Junction. And oddly enough, the little railroad on Petticoat Junction was only 50 miles long. So there's actually sort of a method to the madness on that whole thing.
Yeah, don't tell me
well,
it can't be done.
The point being that the other aspect of this is just the, you know, the lack of competence of the people who are trying to force this on us. And look, I mean, look, a lot of people have these vehicles and they love them. I don't have a problem with it, but I don't like that I have to subsidize it, and I definitely don't like banning the competition. All right? Let people choose what they want. If the EVs are so great and wonderful, and then people will choose them.
Yeah.
You don't need to mandate
it. But see, it's just like anything else, right? It's like hats or fuzzy slippers or mustaches or, you know, I mean, pick a thing. There are people who love all these things. Doesn't mean we all have to have one. You know?
We don't do this with
other things.
These manufacturers, everyone got way out ahead of themselves on this. Way out ahead. You know, the rental car agencies bought all these EVs, and then they found out people at the counter were like, no, I don't want an EV. Give me a regular car. And so
they're like, yeah, I want to get somewhere.
Half of their Teslas, you know, they just dumped a massive number of Teslas. And, you know, you've got all these manufacturers that said, I mean, we're only going EV. We're going to be EV only. Now they're saying, oh, no, actually, we're going to keep making regular cars. And so Mercedes just reversed recently on that. And so, like, all of these reversals are happening, but not in government. Not the one that actually needs to reverse the price,
right,
because it's going to force us, whether we like it or not. And so, you know, look, the people who say it's going to be reversed because it has to be, maybe they're right. But, you know, I don't like to count on things happening. I don't like to count on a bad idea ending just because it's a bad idea. I think it needs a push, and this one definitely does.
Yeah. Yeah, because we have too much of that happens. I have added your support, the CRA to ban Biden's EV mandates right on the page for the show. Just in case somebody's listening after the fact, it's June 2nd, 2024, so it's right on there. And the link takes you directly to the website at American Commitment. And you guys have a really handy letter, Dear Senator So-and-so, and the people get to put their name and all their good stuff in there and press send. So
you can send it exactly as is, or you can edit it however you want, or if you think we're wrong, you can delete it and write the opposite.
Right.
We will get them all delivered. We always get them delivered. So when people go through our site, they actually get replies most of the time. And I've actually had some people tell me, like, you know, I always do these things with groups, and I wonder if they get delivered. But when I do yours, I actually get a reply, and I say, good. That means our site's actually working correctly. So that's
good. And, well, you're not doing things that are meaningless, because I know, you know, members of Congress get all sorts of things that are meaningless, and there comes a time when after about...
Yeah, they tally these things up.
They
do pay attention. They
after
tally
your 10,000 pieces of mail.
You might say, look, we've got hard... You might say, hey, we got four left senators. They don't care. But, you know, everyone cares. They talk up there. Even if yours end up voting the wrong way, they know when there's an issue with a lot of political heat, and as many points of contact as possible do count. They add up.
Yeah. Well, it's better than just being mad at home, right? You can just grumble at home. That accomplishes zero. So I applaud what you guys are doing. Plug your organization for just a little bit, since we always talk about issues, which is great, and that's what you guys work on. But we've got a few minutes here. Give us a pitch on American Commitment.
Well, American Commitment is a national free market organization. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. But we particularly try to focus on the fights that are on the margin, where the outcome is not necessarily already determined. And if we get people a little more involved, a little more engaged, a little more educated, we might actually win and tip the outcome in a more free market direction. And that's why when you go in the Action Center on our website, you'll see a bunch of letters to Congress or into regulatory agencies, and you know, opportunities to do things, to take action, is really what we're oriented around. And kind of our long-term mission is really trying to get more accountability in the for the regulatory actions, the agency actions, and get Congress to step up and fix all these broad, vague laws that let the bureaucrats make the most important economic decisions. And you know, towards that end, there's a bill we've been trying to get done for many years that actually reverses the process, so that instead of agencies doing more or less whatever they want, unless you muster enough votes to stop them, we think it ought to go the other way. They ought to write the proposal, but then have to send it to Congress for affirmative approval, without which it couldn't take effect. And there's a bill that flips that, called the RAINS Act, that we've passed in the House many times, never the Senate, but we got all the Republican presidential candidates to say they would sign it, and we've been surveying the Senate candidates this year, and we're getting pretty good support. So we're going to keep pushing towards that, and if we ever got that done, I think our chances of stopping a lot of the worst of these actions would be much better than they are right now. So those are the major things on American Commitment. I also work with another group called Committee to Unleash Prosperity that I should mention as well. Was founded by Steve Moore, Art Laffer, and Steve Forbes, and that's kind of like the supply side brain trust. And we do a bunch of studies with that group on, you know, various economic issues. And then the big thing is we have a totally free daily newsletter with that that I do the first draft of, and Steve Moore edits it, and we send out pretty much every weekday. And that's totally free if people want to get it. It's got kind of like interesting charts and different issue coverage and what's going on. It's kind of insider political economic type stuff. So the kind of people who are interested in your show would probably enjoy that. And you can get that at committeetounleashprosperity.com.
Nice. Well, there are a lot of organizations. I guess the reason I want you to do that, not only is your organization good, but we're awash in kind of activist organizations, but a lot of them are. We just did a show on the book Arabella with Scott Walter here, I don't know, a month ago when his book first came out. And he was talking about all these activist organizations on the left that are one guy, one guy on a website. And I think we kind of have that too on our side in some cases.
Well, we have some of that. You know, I was very, very sad to see FreedomWorks shut down recently, because For many years, that was a group that really could deliver, you know, big crowds of people and have, you know, a lot of impact and influence in dating back to the Tea Parties. And so, this is not an easy, it's not an easy thing to run a nonprofit. You got to find enough donors to keep the thing afloat. You know, it's, they come and go. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be able to keep America's Commitment going for, I don't know, 10 or 12 years now. And, we're in pretty good shape, and we've got pretty good support from our board and from our key donors, and so we're going to keep at it. And, you know, check. I hope we're considered a real organization. I know that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of groups out there. You never know what you're dealing with. But as I said, you know, when you use our stuff, you pretty much always get a reply. So, you know, or, you know, when we put you into a comment doc, you can go search it and see that it's actually in there. And so, it's pretty clear that when we ask you to do something, it really does. We really do what we say we're going to do.
Well, and your list of action items. Yeah, I would encourage people to go to the Take Action page, because your campaigns you're running, you know, first one, student loans, patent seizures, digital equity, the RAINS Act.
The student loan thing. We were very involved in developing the theory that was successful at the Supreme Court. I think I was the first one to write that Missouri would be the key plaintiff, because they could make the argument that their Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority was harmed, and that would be a good standing argument. And that ended up being the standing argument that the court used. So yeah, it might have been a coincidence, but I like to think somebody in Missouri saw my article, or you know, heard me on a radio station or something, and that helped get that moving. So I take a little bit of credit on that one. Although, of course, you know, after Biden got stopped by the Supreme Court, he said he's doing it anyway, so it might have been a meaningless victory, but it was something.
Yeah. Well, I think that it makes a big difference, and it's helpful. Well, let me go the other way. It's unhelpful when people think that they're getting something done, and then it turns out they're kind of just being scammed for money or clicks or whatever. Then they get discouraged and they don't do anything. So we're always happy to point them to organizations that actually
do stuff. I hate, like, fake petitions. I hate that. That drives me nuts.
And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. I get a lot of phone calls, you know, hey, I got this thing.
Once in a while, I open the spam folder in my text messages, and I see like 300 of these things. So I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because the, they just had MoveOn.org. Do you get their stuff? I love their stuff.
I get their stuff. They write great emails. I get them. I get Progressive Change Campaign Committee. The left sends out very good stuff, but I always want to see what the other side is doing. So
I do too.
On almost every list there is.
I always get the MoveOn.org stuff. I actually forwarded it out to my list because one of the most recent ones, they were they wanted $9. They usually only want three, which was interesting. I'm like, ooh, it's a big one. $9.
Going big.
Chip in $9, and it was to send drag queens to Congress, and they wanted to make sure they had the best makeup and costumes available.
You
got to
go big on that one. Yeah.
It's like, are you guys kidding? I thought, wow, in a really big political election year, this is what they're raising money for. I was kind of excited, actually. Kind of made me happy.
Yep. Keep well, up. You know, as far as the EV products go, I think people really need to step up before it's too late. And in some cases, like our lawn care products that are now all electric, people need to realize that once the manufacturers stop making these products and go electric, the gas stuff's not coming back. I mean, they can't go, oh, okay, now we're gonna fire up and start making them again. They're not set up to make them again, and they're not going to set up.
The only manufacturer that I believe right now is set up to continue making internal combustion vehicles long-term is Toyota. All the others have some plans to shift to all EVs, and you're right, once production lines are switched, they're not coming back.
Yep. No, they're not coming back.
Look at logging. They drove out logging, and now there's no place to take wood, even when we have it. Phil, we have to run away, but we are really grateful to have you on. And anytime you write anything fun, please feel free. We are an ever open platform for you.
Thank you so much. Have a good one, guys.
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks, Phil.
Have a great Sunday. You are listening to We the People. We will be back with Dr. Judith Curry, and you can find us here at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Calibrated the imperfections. I got my slide rule from school. You add it up, and it don't add up. And shed some light on it too. And I'm just inches close to the finish. Cross it and bid you adieu. I calculated every combination, every misdirection, every subtle deception. Kickstart my thinking, I was lost in space, staring at a spot on the moon, negotiating the
good afternoon. This is the second hour of We the People Radio. Today on June 2nd, 2024, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And if you're looking for a mower, a tractor, implements, any kind of yard care products, go up and see them. They've got all that equipment in stock and ready to go. They've got all your electric riding equipment, handheld equipment. It's all there. Go up and see them. They also have a fully trained parts and service department. They can fix most anything up there. And they're located in the city of Shasta Lake, or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Mm-hmm.
There you are.
Where you can get all those mandated electric...
That's right. We follow the law, and the law says you have to buy electric, so you come up and see us. We'll sell you an electric one.
We'll sell you electric stuff.
That's right.
You guys have a lot of electric stuff.
We do.
Handheld stuff. And
yep, we got all the trimmers and edgers and... weed whackers, or as they say in Australia, the whippersnippers.
The whippersnippers.
Yeah, yeah. We have those. They've got electric riders. They've got it all going on right now. And the tractors, thank goodness, right now are still all diesel-powered. So you can still get your diesel-powered John Deere tractor. So go up and see them.
Nice. Well, that's what we talked about the first hour, just in case you missed that part, was the mandates to... have gas-powered cars in the next few years, even though the manufacturers are saying they can't do it. That doesn't matter. The government's telling them they have to and telling us we have to buy them. So,
yep.
The time,
build it and they will come.
The time to
you won't be able to drive it because you won't be able to charge it. But
No. And here we'll be having a brownout, so it won't
You'll
matter.
You'll be the first. You'll feel good at being the first to save the planet.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, all our topics are frustrating.
Be a leader.
All our topics are frustrating, but we'll make fun of every single one of them, darn it. Just to make it all work.
You know, I had a customer come in the other day, had an electric vehicle, and I said, hey, how do you like that? Oh, I love it. He goes, it's just great. He goes, I haven't been at a gas station for months. And I said, well, good for you. I said, have you taken it anywhere? Oh, yeah, we drove it to Wyoming or someplace. I said, well, how'd that go? Oh, it went fine. Yeah, we didn't have any problem. I said, well, did you, what route did you take? Well, we had to take, we only had a couple of choices there because we had to stay on the route that had the charger. So we couldn't venture off too far. But other than that, it was a great trip. I thought, yeah, other than that.
Other than you didn't get to go where you wanted.
Yeah, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? How ridiculous.
We're turned into dogs now. We can only go as long as that little expando leash goes.
That's right. Then it snaps back and you got to get back there and charge
Mom's
it
Mom's got a new expando leash. It's like 8 feet long.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
It's great.
God. Well, Dr. Judith Curry, she is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN for short. She is a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, actual science, and the American Geophysical Union. So we have had Dr. Curry on here. There is more to this story. We have had her on our show several times.
I remember her.
She's, and my bad.
She's the heretic.
She is the heretic. And
yes.
My bad is I didn't link the previous shows, but I'll I'll get on that right now, right this minute while we're talking. But she was the first person that came to mind while I watched Mayor Pete wax poetic about how turbulence is caused by climate change
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of other dumb stuff. And I knew we were talking about electric cars, and so I said to myself, we have to have Dr. Curry back on, talk to us about some turbulence, since she's actually an expert on extreme weather. So, Dr. Curry, have you recovered from watching Mayor Pete on the news? You probably had to take Maalox or some other stronger
Xanax.
Whiskey, something.
Yeah, I had some fun on Twitter, and and all that sort of forced me to dig into what was going on here. And you won't be surprised, but Mayor Pete was way off base.
What? Mayor Pete? You mean Mayor Pete's not a real climate scientist?
Yeah. Well, okay. There's three types of turbulence that can impact aircraft. Okay. One is like mountain induced. If I live in Reno, Nevada, right near the Sierra Nevadas. And if you've ever tried to, go in for a landing near Reno, it is very, very, very bumpy because those mountains generate waves that cause up and down. So that's a common cause of turbulence that airplanes need to worry about. The other one is deep convective towers, big thunderstorms. I'm sure you've flown over thunderstorms
mm-hmm.
and felt a really bumpy ride.
Oh, yeah.
It sometimes can be a bit scary. And then there's a third category, which is clear air turbulence. There's no mountains, there's no deep convection. And it's just related to what's going on the dynamics of the upper atmosphere. In the vicinity of the jet stream, and this is something that's, in the upper atmosphere around, 30 to 40,000 feet, it's a big band of very fast winds traveling from west to east at very high speeds. And, this changes its location. Sometimes it's wavy, sometimes it's straight, whatever. But associated with the jet stream is a lot of turbulence, at the boundaries. And you can sometimes actually get clear air turbulence that gives the planes quite a jolt, especially, traveling from New York or Boston over to Western Europe. You're right in the path, of the jet stream. So what Mayor Pete was talking about was claiming that clear air turbulence is increasing because of global warming. Okay, and there is a paper out there a couple of papers on this subject, and they look at, how do you tell that it's clear air turbulence? Well, you can diagnose it, from weather analyses related to wind shear and entropy, stretching deformation, and some of these dynamical fields to estimate where you should be seeing clear air turbulence. And looking at the weather analysis data, researchers spotted a trend since 1980 to present in the eastern U.S. and the North Atlantic. Okay, maybe a 20% increase in this clear air turbulence. Okay, so is this believable? It's not implausible.
Okay.
But that there would be an increase since 1980. I mean, it's a little bit of sleight of hand. You've got to make a lot of assumptions before you conclude that. But we're talking about 20%. So if this is real, do you blame it on global warming or the fact that the Atlantic multidecadal oscillation index has increased from 1980 to the present?
I don't remember him talking about that.
No, that's another possible explanation, especially since you see this over the Atlantic Ocean. So that's another possible explanation. But to me, the bigger picture is like, over the U.S., have we seen any increase in turbulence incidents that are reported by airlines? I spotted some statistics from whatever it is, the Safety Transport Board. It must be under Mayor Pete somewhere. that showed that since 1988, the number of reported incidents for turbulence impacting aircraft, and this is all kinds of turbulence, clear air, mountain waves, deep convection, there's no trend. And this is even more surprising since the number of flights over that period, since 1988, over the U.S. has increased substantially. So there's no evidence of increased turbulence impacting aircraft. So, you know, what are we to make of this? Well, okay, in this particular instance of the Singapore Airlines, the Singapore is already the transportation ministry or whatever it's called over there. They've done a preliminary analysis. What happened is the aircraft was subject to a big boom. I mean, it gained a lot of altitude, you know, like several thousand feet in a very short time and a forward acceleration. And so the pilots tried to compensate by bringing the aircraft down. And so it was those two things that, you know, that gave it the big jolt. Now, they were close to Myanmar, and there are radars, you know, off the coast of India that, you know, was covering that region. And there was definitely, you know, storms, thunderstorms in the region. So it's not too far-fetched, you know, to think that this was, particular instance was related to a big thunderstorm updraft that caused that turbulence. It's consistent with the accelerometer data from the aircraft itself. So it looks like it was old-fashioned, you know, thunderstorm causing,
what?
You know, bumpy aircraft.
It was weather? Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was, you know, so this is so far what it looks like. It was basically a thunderstorm. And, you know, the weather radar data in that part of the world isn't as sophisticated as what you have, you know, in the U.S. or Western Europe or whatever. But it's enough to tell you that there it was stormy, and they just got unlucky where they, you know, flew. You know, they got caught by a big updraft. And I guess some passengers didn't have their seatbelts fastened, and then that's why we had even a casualty. So, you know, it's not unusual, but there's no evidence that turbulence is increasing. So, you know, Mayor Pete is really off base on that one. what they need is, you know, better sensors on the aircraft so they can, you know, sense what's up ahead and, you know, really have to enforce that, you know, seatbelt thing. Because, you know, everybody starts off with their seatbelts, and then they leave them on until they get up to go to the bathroom or something. And then when they get back in their seat, they may not put them back on.
Sure.
And, you know, that failure is, you know, what might have been fatal in this particular instance.
Well, I heard later that the fatality on that flight was actually a heart attack. It wasn't from an injury from hitting the roof or flying out of his seat. No, it was a
heart, oh, my gosh. Okay.
It was a heart attack.
That's even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, and this is a problem. When we blame everything on climate change, it gives us, it's like a cop-out for not dealing with the real problems. Okay, we need better sensors on the aircraft so they can monitor, you know, the weather environment in real time, not just relying on, you know, air traffic control or whatever and radio reports. They need to be able to monitor it in real time. And whenever you're flying through convection, it may not seem too bad, but you cannot, can always be a surprise, you know, a deep power that pops up and surprises you. So rather than, you know, blame climate change and, oh my gosh, if only we'd stop burning fossil fuels, there would be no more clear air turbulence. You know, that we need to have better sensors on the aircraft so they can have better situational awareness.
Well, I think that's, you know, what you were saying about let's blame it on climate change. It seems like any disaster, you know, foul weather, you know, all these tornadoes we're having, hurricanes, they're all being blamed, or at least the increase is being blamed on climate change. And how much truth is there to those stories? I mean, that hurricanes are more intense and more frequent, and tornadoes are more intense and more frequent. Is that, are those stories true?
No, not at all. You know, this year has been a bad tornado year in the U.S. And we're just getting started. There's more to the season. But until this year, there had been an overall decline for decades in the number of tornadoes in the U.S. So this year is a big uptick.
Yeah.
Okay, but
hold that thought, and let's come back on tornadoes. Darn it, got a good song on tornadoes, and dang it. Maybe I can get it. Maybe I can get it for the second half. We've got to take a quick break. It's just my crisis I aired for you all out loud.
Thanks for that.
Feels like shaking his head. Why are you saying this? Oh, my goodness. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and we were helping you with turbulence. You can go about your lives now. Global warming is not causing turbulence. We're all free to move about the cabin, but as soon as we sit down, put your seatbelt on. That's what we've learned.
Because there was an earthquake in L.A. today, and that could have been climate change as well. So you should
hope you were in an airplane with your seatbelt on.
Strap in your recliner, too.
Such a bunch of Weisenheimers. We'll be right back, though. We're going to talk about tornadoes. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
So take my soul. That's what you said. But who are we to know?
You never disappoint.
There you go, Mayor Pete. There's your tornado. I knew I had a song about tornadoes. So we've had fewer tornadoes, but
in the last few years.
Am I starting to guess what they're up to? Are they going to tell us that this is the most we've ever had, like in a million years or something?
I think that's a hard one to pull off. I mean, there have been a lot of really big seasons, like especially in the 70s. Again, when I was in graduate school, again, I was at University of Chicago. One of the faculty members was Ted Fujita, Mr. Tornado. He invented all those tornado scales and all of this kind of stuff. So I was, you know, really into the tornado thing. But, the 70s was really bad time for tornadoes. You know, the last decade has really been pretty benign. Last two decades even been pretty benign for tornadoes. I mean, this is a big year, but very, very far from a record-breaking year, and it's certainly not part of a trend. This year, we've had some weird weather patterns. I mean, in May, we had that huge heat dome over Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, and the southern states, Florida, Miami. It's just insane heat. Okay, broke a number of records in Miami. This is big heat dome. You know, it's starting to, you know, move north and whatever now. It's finally breaking up, but it's just part of natural weather variability. The same time as that heat dome, in the western U.S., we've been cool. We've had anomalously cool weather in May. In Reno, Nevada, where I live, I mean, we've only had a few days that have, you know, made it to the 80s so far, so we've been very cool. So you have this cool air mass in the west and the big heat dome to the south, and, you know, the circulation patterns associated with those two things, it's a bad recipe for the Great Plains and the Midwestern states in terms of severe weather. And so they've just been cranking out the severe weather in late May. But, you know, those patterns are changing, and, you know, we'll see what, you know, the weather roulette table has in store for us. But, you know, there's no trend in tornadoes. And even the UN climate assessment report acknowledges that there's been no trend in tornadoes and no reason to expect an increase in tornadoes from global warming. So that one's really pretty much off the table.
I'm still going to put some money on that one. I am, because they love doing that, and they know nobody's going to go do the homework. They're going to tell everybody that don't listen to Dr. Judith Curry. She's a climate heretic. She's looking at facts. She's using science.
Yeah. Well, and the rest of us are all just, president said, we'll take truth over facts any day. I mean, come on.
Well, and we're just all a bunch of dummies driving not electric cars, right? So what do we know? We, yeah.
Okay, well, now hurricanes.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Okay, but this is the big story.
Okay.
Everybody is predicting a blowout. Well, almost everybody's predicting a blowout year for hurricanes
no
in the Atlantic. Okay. The reasons are we have extremely warm temperatures in the tropical Atlantic and the Caribbean and now the Gulf. And we're headed towards a La Nina. Okay, both of these things are recipes for a bad season. There are some mitigating factors that my forecast team looks at, so we're not expecting as huge a blowout as some other people are forecasting, but it's going to be an extremely active year anyway you slice it. So how much of this is global warming? Well, there are some simple theories that say that with warmer sea surface temperatures, you should get more intense hurricanes. Okay, but those theories don't do a very good job on the moist thermodynamics of hurricanes. And I was just reading a paper today on this, you know, showing, you know, how there's a penalty to warmer sea surface temperatures in terms of the kinetic energy, the mechanical energy of the hurricanes and the maximum wind speed. So this is, you know, there's hypotheses out there that we should have stronger hurricanes in a warmer climate. But the data is so noisy. There's so much year-to-year variability. The signals are very hard to tease out. You know, in some regions, you could maybe tease out a signal. But is that multi-decadal natural climate variability or the global warming trend? You know, it's hard to separate out. Now, the interesting thing is that both climate models actually predict fewer hurricanes in a warming climate.
Okay. Really?
Maybe more intense, but fewer hurricanes.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, so there you have it. But the signal will be small enough that it's not of both, is really not going to make any difference, you know, given the year-to-year variability. The one signal, and this is what I would expect from this year with the very warm sea surface temperatures, is that when something does hit land, it'll be carrying a lot of water and it will rain a lot. You know, even tropical storms, the weaker systems, you know, if they're moving slow enough, they can produce big floods. So I think in terms of landfalls, my company's predicting 4 U.S. landfalls this year, with the focus in the Gulf of Mexico, unfortunately. So I think we are going to see significant number of landfalls this year, but I think that the hopefully there's not going to be any extremely strong ones like we, but I think there will be a lot of rain. So this is going to be a bad hurricane year. There's no way around it, but attributing any of this to global warming is really pretty dubious. There is some evidence, both in observations and just from general theory, that we should expect more rain with the warmer sea surface temperatures. And, you know, that's plausible. But again, the data is so noisy, and it's very hard to compare individual storms and individual locations because there's so much variability. But if global warming was associated with more rainfall from hurricanes, that wouldn't surprise me. But, yeah, we've had, you know, the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes were in the 1930s. You know, big one hitting Florida and a big one hitting New England. I mean, these are the, you know, the two record holders. You know, we've seen some bad ones, certainly in the 21st century. But in terms of, you know, the big record breakers for U.S. landfalls, it really was in the 1930s, believe it or not. So, you know, it's going to be a bad year this year. And I think everybody's prepared for it, at least all the emergency management and the electric utilities and the insurance companies. You know, everybody's, you know, as prepared as they can be. You know, it's up to individual people, you know, to secure their personal and household safety.
Sure. So if they stop driving their car, it's not going to magically fix it, though. Bottom line.
You know, the bottom line is, you know, apart from heat waves that have some, you know, obvious association with global warming, the other extreme events, they simply do not correlate with, you know, an increasing global average temperature. I mean, they don't. I mean, a lot of really bad weather, you know, in the 1900s. It was, you know, significantly cooler than it is now. You know, the worst atmospheric river and floods in California, that was, you know, in 1861, 1862. You know, a lot of the stuff simply does not scale with global average temperature apart from heat waves. But the good news is that the cold events are declining. You know, fewer cold outbreaks, and more people die from cold events than from heat events by an order of magnitude. You never hear that.
That's awkward, right?
I don't know. So, you know, this whole thing about using extreme weather events and blaming them on global warming, you know, the people are trying, it's propaganda, really, trying to amp up the alarm and the urgency for getting rid of fossil fuels. And the real irony of this, you know, if we start jeopardizing our electricity supply, we're going to increase our vulnerability to extreme weather. You know, if we have tons of electricity, we can pump water, and we can have desalination plants, and we can, you know, protect our infrastructure and this, that, and the other. If we don't have electricity and if we're poverty-stricken, we're going to be a lot more vulnerable to whatever Mother Nature throws at us. So our first line of defense is abundant and reliable electricity. That's our first line of defense for extreme weather.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, low resources and, you know, by way of fuels and all that, that was the pre-industrial era, and those are lots of third world countries. And as soon as we figured out energy production, it all opened up. Why?
Exactly.
Any thought besides, like, just, you know, your basic power and control and evilness? Like, why would they want to put us back to a pre-industrial period by all this lying and scaring and, you know, trying to walk you into your prison cell and you know, cement in your own bars and lock the door on yourself. Like, what's the point?
Well, you know, there's a world out there, you know, that the environment comes first and that it's very fragile and that humans are a blight on the environment. And we would really be better off if there were a lot less humans and they didn't use resources and this, that, and the other. I mean, you know, it's sort of a neo-Malthusian mindset, if that word means anything to you. And it's, there is that mindset, and then there's also power and control. I mean, all of this alarm about the environment, you know, it's a pretext for, you know, non-government world control by the United Nations. And you know, this has been, you know, their dream for decades. They're trying to do it with the World Health Organization as well as the climate change issue. And the World Health Organization thing, whereby the WHO controls all the pandemic responses and this, that, and the other, there's a lot of backlash against that. And I think there's growing backlash against all these, you know, UN rules and regulations. So, you know, it's power, control, and just a worldview of, you know, this neo-Malthusian worldview of the environment comes first, you know, and humans are a blight on the planet, that I think is driving this. It sounds stupid, but there's a long history, you know, going back to the 1950s, you know, in the UN and the Rockefeller Foundation and all this kind of stuff. We've been developing these ideas and pushing it, and, you know, all the while, you know, certain people make a lot of money and gain a lot of power, and they preach morality, and a lot of people fall for it. And, you know, it's a complicated situation in terms of how we got to this rather stupid place. But I think we need to do more work to understand how we got here if we're going to have any chance of unraveling it.
Yeah. I would imagine as a, and we've spoken with you about this before, but this is annoying for those of us who are not scientists. You know, we can't really tell you why turbulence it isn't global warming, but we know it's not. If you actually know the facts, this has to be one of those things where you probably have to just like turn the TV off or, you know, shut these people off and take a breath every now and then. Gotta be just frustrating as hell.
Yeah, it's no. I don't know what drives, you know, but people are tuning out because a lot of it doesn't make sense. And like last year, the temperature breached the 1.5 degrees centigrade threshold that people, you know, of warming since pre-industrial times that we were told was, you know, existential crisis, highway to climate hell, you know, code red alert. And, okay, well, nothing bad happened.
Oops.
Okay, yeah, well, we had some heat waves. But other than that, the hurricanes globally were very tame. You know, there were no big, huge floods or droughts or, you know, it was a pretty normal year. You know, in spite of the fact that we breached the 1.5 degree centigrade threshold. So people are saying, okay, well, so what? You know, like maybe I should put this one on the shelf and worry about something else. I think they overplayed their hand with all this alarm and all these thresholds of disaster. And once we pass those thresholds and nothing bad happens, you know, people start to roll their eyes.
It seems like that's always, yeah, that's always the play, though, is do the scare and gloom and doom, and, you know, 1.5 degrees is, that's going to be it. You know, we're going to, the point of no return, and then it happens and nothing happens. It's the same scenario over and over and over. And I think you're right. I think people are starting to kind of get wise to a lot of this and using common sense that, you know, really a degree and a half is going to melt the planet. No, it won't. It won't. So I think we need to take a break.
Well, we do. But I just sent him the songs because I was screwing around and wasn't paying attention. So, you know, full disclosure, I was having such a good time thinking about all the craziness. I got swept up in it.
Yeah,
I got carried away.
Craziness. I mean, I'll always go back to what was Al Gore's book?
I was just going to say, Bill has a total thing about Al Gore's book. He's like, everything in there is a lie.
It is. I want to do a show on that book and just take it point by point, because everything is past.
Yeah, right.
that was predicted in that book, and none of it came true. So the inconvenient truth.
Yeah. And the inconvenient truth is that none of it was true.
Yeah, that's the inconvenient part.
It's an inconvenient title, really. Bill Neustadt read his own book.
Yeah, the inconvenient title.
The inconvenient title. I don't know how you show. I don't know how you keep showing up. I mean, that's like the height of hubris, right?
Yeah.
You keep showing up at your climate conference when you've written a book about everything that has already not happened.
Yeah.
And you're the expert.
All right. So.
All right. So, have I given you enough time in there, in the box? Are we good?
Oh, yeah, we're good.
Oh my God! Yeah, take a really quick break. Well, better switch to decaf. Let's all switch to decaf, and we'll come right back with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, I just try to make believe that everything you're telling me is true. Come on, baby, won't you do?
Rising, well, that's all right with me, 'cause there ain't no other place than on the sea I'd rather be. And that second coming's coming, it's right around the bend, and someday could be any day this world is gonna end. But that's all right, that's okay. There ain't nothing we can do about the whole thing anyway. It's a hang-on kind of ride. We're spinning through space and time, rocking this big old rock, just trying to have some fun. So let's drink another beer. Here's to another year. Let's take another crazy trip around the sun.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but...
It's a crazy ride, that's for sure.
Yeah, I just wonder, how do these people go to these conferences and stuff and with a straight face? I mean, is it so far gone that that's just widely accepted?
There's a big, sort of groupthink mentality that's set in. I mean, the whole climate problem and policy solutions have been framed very narrowly, and everybody's working from within inside that narrow little box. And, they're often dotting each other's I's and crossing each other's T's and not making any meaningful progress in understanding, because they're sitting inside this little box. And until you step outside of that box and start looking at real natural weather and climate variability and a whole broad range of policy options and different decision-making frameworks, you'll never get anywhere. And that's what I tried to put out there in my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. I know we've talked about the book on my previous interviews, but it's really...
We should
really
keep talking about it, though, because it's a good one.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, it's sort of, how to step outside the box and take a much broader perspective about this issue. Speaking of my book, it's now available in audio book version, which was a long time coming, but it's out now, and I'm very happy about that.
Nice. Did you have to read it yourself, or did you get somebody to do it?
No, somebody, my publisher took care of that. I don't even know. I think it's probably some artificial intelligence type voice.
Nice. As long as it doesn't sound like the people that you get when your phone malfunctions and you have to call India. God bless you, God bless you, Indians, but, there's enough of that. We don't want to hear a whole book.
Right. But, this is why everybody has just gotten so group thinking. And the urgency, you know, all the UN and national leaders and whatever talking about the urgency of this, people just say, well, we don't have time to rethink this. We don't have time to think. We don't have time to develop new power generation options. You know, it's urgent. We don't have time to think. We just need to do. So it's this urgency, a sense of urgency that's making people stupid and make really poor decisions. And it also impacts, you know, the scientists, because the scientists, you know, the whole reward system for their careers is set up, you know, to they will succeed if they amplify the alarm.
No, you're right. I think anytime they say anything is urgent and needs immediate change, it's usually the opposite. I mean, look at, I think it was AOC said we had 12 years before the whole thing comes crashing down. Well, I think we're halfway there, and I'm not sure the sea levels have risen at all since then.
Oh, they're creeping along at about 3 millimeters per year. What does 3 millimeters mean? Well, if you stack two pennies on top of each other.
Yeah, and we're not smart enough to mitigate that, that rise, or recognize that level of increase and move all our cities off the coast
by
a couple of miles.
At the same time that's happening, you have people like the Obamas that are buying mansions on the coastline. So it's like, what does that say? Well, I mean, I know what that says, but what does that say?
Yeah, and, you know, the locations where locations, you do measure a big sea level rise, but those locations are where the ground is sinking, okay, either from natural geologic processes or from groundwater withdrawal, you know, just pumping out the groundwater, and building big cities on top of the soil that compresses things down. Like a lot of sea level rise near Louisiana, that's associated with actually the extraction of oil and gas from the land, and also groundwater withdrawal. Okay, and so that's caused the land to sink. But worse yet, the way they engineered the Mississippi River, you don't get that sediment enrichment of the delta, the ongoing enrichment of the delta, which is sort of starving the delta of sediment. So, you know, the coastline is disappearing. So humans are causing a lot of sinking of the ground, and you blame it on sea level rise. Mm-hmm. But now the real killer is San Francisco, like the airport. I mean, that's built on landfill, and they're worried that it's sinking. Well, it's landfill. They didn't engineer the landfill very well.
Yeah, Venice much?
There's a lot of these places. Oh, in Indonesia, Jakarta, capital city, I mean, just sinking like crazy, like 22 feet a year or something is nuts.
Wow.
So they've actually moved the capital inland. So, you know, a lot of this is man-made. You know, when you look at a location where sea level rise is a problem, invariably it's some man-made actions that are substantially contributing to the problem.
Right, and I think that can be substantiated by looking at an area, say San Francisco, and they say, oh, the sea level rises. Well, the sea level doesn't rise just in San Francisco, but not in San Jose, or, you know, not in Seattle.
Or San Diego.
It doesn't work that way. I mean, the whole Pacific Ocean would come up equally if it was a sea level change. I mean, am I off base there?
No, pretty good, but there's also ocean circulation patterns that cause the sea to pile up in one location or pull away from another location. For example, in the Pacific, the ocean circulation patterns act to pull the water away from the coast, so the sea level rises less on the Pacific coast, the U.S. Pacific coast, than the U.S. Atlantic coast, where the circulation patterns in the Atlantic tend to push the water towards the coast. So there's a lot of factors going on.
Right. And which that makes sense. I mean, that I can believe. Now, there's been a lot of talk lately about these glaciers cracking off and melting. Is what's the story there? Can you talk about that?
Okay. Well, is it two places that are at issue: Greenland and then Antarctica. Looking at Greenland first, because the Greenland ice cap, you know, was really big, say around 1850 or whatever, there was a huge amount of ice accumulation, and then you had all these ice shelves and whatever. And so as we have some warming, some of those are breaking off. And those do melt, and they do, you know, increase sea level rise. But at the same time, there's a lot of snowfall accumulating on Greenland. And so the mass balance of Greenland is how much snow falls, how much of it melts on the surface, and how much icebergs break off. And there's a lot of year-to-year variability. There's a lot of multi-decadal variability. The current sort of period for mass loss from Greenland started in about 1995, and this coincided when there was a big change in the Atlantic circulation patterns in the ocean and the atmosphere. So, I mean, this period of Greenland mass loss, I think, had a natural trigger, which was exacerbated by global warming. So there has been some, the mass loss from Greenland peaked in about 2010. Since then, the mass loss has slowed down quite a bit. And once we switch to the cold phase of the Atlantic circulation pattern, you know, we could even see a period of accumulation, or at least a bigger slowdown of the loss. So, you know, the Greenland situation is relatively stable. The biggest concern is really the West Antarctic ice sheet, okay, which is a marine ice sheet. It's a small part of the Antarctic continent. But if you took away all the ice, the land would actually be underwater. Okay, so the fact that they have an ice sheet near the surface is that it extends from the big continental glacier out into the ocean. Okay, and so this is not a very stable situation. So the ice in this region moves pretty rapidly, and you're always getting big icebergs break off. So could something really bad happen to the West Antarctic ice sheet? Could it disappear? Well, it, you know, 119,000 years ago in the last interglacial, I think the West Antarctic ice sheet was smaller than it is now. So, I mean, that still, you know, could shrink more. But the real issue of concern in my mind is there's a bunch of under ice volcanoes that are heating this from below. Okay. But,
gosh, why don't we talk about that more often?
I know.
Wonder.
I know. And then the other issue is that the West Antarctic ice sheet, it's pretty elastic, so when you lose some ice, it actually rises. You know, the geologic forces sort of rebound and it pushes it up. So I'm not very concerned about the West Antarctic ice sheet in the near term, but this is the one that gets all the hype. Mm-hmm. And if something was to really bad happen with sea level rise, it would come from the West Antarctic ice sheet, and probably more likely those under ice volcanoes.
You mean they would actually melt the ice?
From below.
Well, darn.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, we can do something about that.
Stop driving right now, because that's gonna stop, and I'll stop using underarm deodorant or whatever it is we got to stop doing these days.
Right.
Oh, it was hairspray. Sorry, I got that confused.
You know, so natural climate variability, you know, can be pretty wild and crazy, but that's completely ignored. You know, and we're just, you know, focused on, you know, global warming is really a slow creep. Like I said, 3 millimeters a year for you know, sea level rise, mm-hmm. and the glaciers melt a little bit, and it's just a slow creep, and it's something that we can easily adapt to. But, you know, they amp it up in trying to tie it to extreme weather events, which is really unjustified. Then they talk about tipping points, you know, once we get past this threshold.
That's right. That's right. There's the point of no return.
That's the part that always gets me, and the part that I think most people should be wary of is the urgency and the tipping point. It's like once we hit that, all bets are off.
Guys, we have hit a tipping point. You know that's a nice segue right there into the end right there. The end. Dr. Judith Curry, we love you. We think you're the best. And I think people should go to Climate Etc., her blog at judithcurry.com, and read her book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Yeah, we're going to call you back as this thing develops.
This isn't going anywhere.
Sea level, you know, rises another foot. Well, we won't wait till it goes up a foot.
Coming back!
It'll be another million years.
All right,
years,
you can find us at We the People. Radio.us.
.us.
Ah, cheated.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.